This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Today's episode is part of a series of conversations we recorded at the Shelton Brothers Festival back in August in Atlanta. A phenomenal gathering of some of the best brewers in the world, as well as a few niche cider and winemakers, all holding their own in one of the most diverse and interesting product portfolios that's ever been assembled. The folks from Shelton Brothers gave us a room and free rein to curate talks with anyone we wanted on any topics we wished. It's a somewhat speedy series of interviews, much shorter than you're used to on GBH, and that's because we wanted to see if a series of topics might emerge, a pattern of sorts, that might give us an indication of what's on people's mind at this point in time in this particular portfolio of producers. And I think it kind of worked. Also, on a few of these episodes, you'll hear from a couple of other folks from GBH that drop in from time to time, so you might hear from Blake Tyers and Kyle Kisronik as well. This episode features Sarah and James Howitt of Black Project Ales in Denver, Colorado. Listen in.
Hi, my name is Sarah Howitt. I am a co-founder, and I like to call myself the party thrower.
All right.
At Black Project.
Nobody else will call you that? You have to do it yourself?
I mean, I think people would call me that.
All right.
They have to experience the party first, but...
I don't call her that, but I'm James Howitt, and I'm the brewer and blender and co-founder at Black Project along with Sarah. Basically, I think I handle the beer stuff. She handles
people, things.
People and finances and everything but beer. She handles
I tell him
keeping
where to
me
go.
On track and everything, so yeah.
Seems like a helpful division of labor. I don't know. You gotta do that somehow. Yeah, tell me about where you guys are from and what you're trying to accomplish out there.
So,
want to start with you?
So I'm from Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
I went to undergrad for marketing and always knew that I wanted to open a business, didn't really know what, and then I met James, and he, over a period of a couple weeks, convinced me to open a brewery.
It only took a couple weeks?
Yeah,
that's you must be a great pitchman.
Pretty much.
He is a great pitchman.
I was
homebrewing
pretty epically, and it was probably not much more than a couple
so
weeks.
So humble.
Between, I mean, I'm just being honest. I'm not saying I'm a great pitchman, but maybe you're gullible. It could be, I don't know.
Could
it
be.
Worked out, so we don't need to really go beyond that.
I am a natural blonde. It's a combination of
could
both.
Be a combination of the two, yeah. Gullible yeah. And pitching.
I had my crap together before I pitched her the idea, but then she finally was like, okay. First she was like, no, but then pretty quickly she was like, well, all right.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, what did the pitch sound like to you? Do you remember that?
I had spreadsheets.
So, he did have spreadsheets. So we kind of fell in love with beer together, actually. We went to New Belgium and did the tour there and had La Folie for the first time.
Mm.
And that was really kind of an eye-opener for us.
As good a place as any to start with your inspiration.
I've done their tour 5 or 6 times now, and it's always great. But I think... His beer was good, and he wanted to go to the Davis program.
Mm-hmm.
And we just looked at the kind of the cost and the timeline and thought, you know, I believed in his product enough to think that it would be worth it just to go for it and just dive in, you know, full speed ahead. And so it did take a few weeks just because of my logical side that was holding back a little bit, but I did believe in his product and just thought we should go for it.
Yeah. Tell me about those early homebrews you were making. Like how did they connect to the future of what you were making now?
I mean, so I don't know. I did all kinds of stuff. So I mean, the whole story is when we opened a brewery called Former Future Brewing Company, which was a sort of neighborhood tap room. We made all kinds of beers with a big focus on historical styles and sort of like modern twists on them. And ultimately, that's a little bit what Black Project is. We're taking spontaneous fermentation, which is arguably the oldest type of it for sure is the oldest type of inoculation when making beer. And we do that in some traditional ways and also some like really experimental ways. It ended up becoming sort of a side project and different branding just because we weren't doing other sour beers really. Too much. Yeah. And so we ended up making a separate brand, and then that sort of just eclipsed everything, and it became our goal to just do that.
So now that just leads the way for you.
We don't do any other beers. We switched the tap room over a little over a year ago. Before that, it was Black Project, which was just bottle releases.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was doing all kinds of beers, but I liked doing sour beers. I did quite a few sour beers at home and was experimenting a lot with wild yeast and reading a ton and learning a ton about spontaneous fermentation. It is difficult to do spontaneous fermentation or like lambic style, lambic inspired beers at home. Just the physics of it, of doing 5 gallons, is not the same to cool 5 gallons as it is to cool, you know, 300 gallons or whatever. So I didn't have much of a success with that, but I knew we wanted to do it, and we're going to do it as former future, and we ended up just sort of kind of we did a Kickstarter for that, which didn't go. And
for former future
to get a cool ship, actually probably like we have now, and didn't happen. It was a last minute change on if our membership could be part of it or not. And so we
scrapped it,
just sort of, yeah, didn't do it, except I had some big stock pots that I used and took money out of the register to go buy a barrel here or there, and like just when we could afford it, like did a little stuff. And that was, most of the people who work for us didn't even know I was doing these brews at night and didn't even know anything about it, because it was like, maybe this is going to suck and I don't want to put it out there too much. And we went to dinner in the first JBF, and I was like, hey, here's this beer I made. And they were like, you've been putting this on the roof? Like, what is going on? So our first cool ship was two giant stock pots on the roof, 60 gallons a piece. And we do 120 gallon boil basically. So we did that, and we then decided to come up with a name for it. So that's kind of how Black Project was born.
I mean, looking back on that in hindsight, like, what do you think psychologically former future represented? Was that sort of like a safe move on your way to doing something that you really wanted to do?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as a brewer, I was super interested in spontaneous fermentation and wild mixed cultures, the wild ecosystem of spontaneous fermentation. And I went to school for microbiology, and so that was part of that interest for me. But I think the timeline of doing that and the risk involved of doing that, it was like, nobody.
Not that
US,
good of a pitch man, huh?
Very few people. I would say very few people in the U.S. were doing that, and I don't think anybody at that time was doing it exclusively.
The foresight to know that would have been kind of a direction.
Also, yeah.
It was impossible to know that that's the way it was going. We knew that we had a passion for it. But as business people, you still have to be smart, and in some ways, as first time business owners, you have to stay a little bit safe, because it's scary enough just to open a business.
Sure. Yeah.
And so we knew that I like to think of ourselves as like very inclusive, and we're very much about our like family of customers and our members and people that have supported us, and it's very much personal for us. And so I think we wanted to keep it community focused, and for us that meant we had to kind of brew the people's beer, which might mean an IPA or a porter or a cream ale or something like that.
I still like
they were all great beers. Yeah.
I just don't anymore, but I kind of sometimes wish we could. We've sort of restricted ourselves to be only spontaneous, only cool ship caught microbes. And
how come? What's helpful or productive for you about constraining what you're going to brew?
I think it's important. Just it's part of focus in a business, I think, to always have something that's guiding you, and usually that guiding ends up being a restriction. I think in some of the best businesses is like, we do it this way, we don't do it these other ways. You know, Ferrari made a SUV. It might suck. And you're gonna tell me they do now, and I don't shop Ferrari, so I don't know. Ferrari, right? They make sports cars, and that means they don't make pickup trucks,
right?
And maybe they're missing out on some huge amount of money for that, but they're good at what they do because they focus on one thing. And so that's kind of what
we, was there anything that happened in the, when, you know, when you look at the larger opportunity there from a business perspective, was there anything that happened over the course of those couple of years that gave you more confidence from a business perspective that this might work out?
Yeah. I mean, we started selling bottles about 8 months after our first brew. We sold the first batch. It won a GABF medal. We started selling bottles as they became available, which was like 1 month we sold them, and then like 4 months later we sold another one, and it was very small batches. And then, you know, 4 months after that, and then as we were like, we're gonna get to one a month, and like we still don't do one a month, but we have a whole tap room now, which sometimes balances it out. But that's our goal, is to get to one a month, and we pretty much could now. And so I think just seeing that take off and seeing like, oh wow, this is a lot of bottles. Like the first time we did 2 oak barrels worth, and it was just like, oh man, I don't know, it's just, This is twice as much, and it was just like, it was gone that day. Like, and now that seems like such a small amount of beer. And so
I got to imagine that, you know, coming to Shelton Fest and pouring here and seeing so many other people kind of rolling the dice on the, that same sort of value proposition would give you a lot of confidence as well. I mean, I would imagine that would inspire both confidence and anxiety at the same time in some ways. Because it's become, I mean, as small as that segment of the market is, there are a lot more people doing it now than ever before. And so when people start talking about sour beer, that conversation is just like this big raucous kind of part of the industry right now. So I guess where do you find confidence from now, and where does your anxiety come in?
I mean, I would say my confidence comes from the fact that, I mean, most breweries, it seems like, now make a sour beer. I think some of my confidence comes from the fact that it's what we do. It's all we do. And I don't even, I mean, we call them sour ales or whatever, but truly we're making spontaneous ales, which is, to me, a little bit different thing. We're not focusing on high acidity. We're taking a long time to make the beers and focusing on complexity, which is, I think, a little bit different than a lot of sours that are being made. That's not good or bad, but it is a different piece of a small segment of the market. And so that gives me some confidence. And I think what makes me nervous, I mean, I don't know. All of our beer not turning out in the barrel, right? I mean,
having to dump every
We switched this year, this past season. We're about to use our second season, but we got a new cool ship, and now it's indoors, and it's bigger. We double batch into it, and it's, like, not on the roof. And we had done that for 3 years, and it worked, and it was like, uh-oh, like, what happens? Like, this might suck. What if? But luckily it's turned out, but, like, that made me anxious for a while. It was like, you brew all this beer, and we had almost 100 oak barrels of this, you know, sort of lambic inspired beer, and I was like, what if this doesn't work? Like, again.
Yeah, you know, don't have those porters and stouts and pilsners to fall back on. So at this point,
much bigger like step and much bigger like investment and risk, I guess, to do it, but it worked fine. So
I think for me, I always go back to the, if you have a good product, that's one thing, but if you treat people well, that's a whole nother thing. And I really pride us, my whole team, really, on just customer interactions and really trying to, like, let people know that we brew these beers for them. It's fun for us, but it's really, if they like it, that's what it's about. And I trust James as a blender and as a brewer to make these beers, and I trust that they'll taste good. But that gives me confidence, just knowing that if you treat people well, that's really the end goal, I think, for a lot of businesses. What gives me anxiety? Yeah, having to dump every single batch of beer.
Have enough beer.
Yeah, on a day-to-day basis. It gives me
anxiety because it gives her anxiety.
It does.
How many beers are we going to have on tap in 3 weeks? I'm like,
Can I send this pellet to Shelton? I don't know.
Yeah. When's that Shelton pellet going to go out? I don't know.
Conditioning bottles gives me anxiety. Just making enough beer. I think we just hired a production manager, and he's really helped us nail down, like, timelines. We really want to stick to a certain minimum for our beers, and so he's helped us stick to that and also make sure we get beer out the door. But that's always anxiety producing for me.
Yeah, it's good because he really understands, like, shout out to Ed if you're listening to this, but he really understands that, like,
the time piece of that.
We can't schedule it out like we could if we were a clean brewery where we know, like, okay, this beer will be done here. But he still is able to work with me, and, like, I just sometimes just download a bunch of ideas, and he's like, that's great, he's a big fan also, a big beer fan in general, and fan of these kinds of beers, and so he'll listen to my ideas and just be, like, writing down notes furiously, and then try and find a way to, like, fit in time to do those brews, and
he understands that time is invaluable when it comes to these beers.
Right, it's timeline is not even, it's not even really a timeline, it's just a continuous pressure to make sure that things are getting, basically just we're brewing as much as we possibly can.
Sounds like an ongoing negotiation between fermentation and production and operations.
It's really about brewing as much as we can, and then if we really are brewing as much as we can, and every tank is full when it needs to be or as soon as it can be, every barrel is full, then we give it as much time as possible, and we'll have a lot more beer than if we're, you know, we're not working optimally, which is really what he does. Mm-hmm. So
seems like there's also a really strong kind of amount of trust between you as business partners here, and obviously
that's not true. No, there is.
I mean, it's come up a few different times in the way that you've described things. It's like, you know, you really trusting him as a brewer and a blender, and you really trusting her to handle the sort of human touch element of the business and forecasting some of those things. I got to imagine that took a little while. Like, that kind of trust evolves. You don't just get it automatically.
Yeah. It's tough. I think it's always tough, like, working with your spouse, especially on it when it's your own business and you're both the boss, like, equally so. I mean, we've seen many brewery owners that start married and end up not married. And so we talked about that. I pitched this idea to her when we were engaged. Mm. So, but she said yes before we got married. So. but yeah, I mean, I think it's something that's like a constant thing you're working on. And I think division of like who's in charge of what has been important. But I mean, we have friends that have started breweries, you know, and they're going into it married, and it was interesting having talks with them even sometimes, you know, about how that goes. It's, I think with anybody, but when you have to go home also, it's like, you can't complain about your business partner.
We turn our phones off when we go home.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
There's no phone at the table when we're home. So, that's really been helpful. Just trying to set boundaries for, where and how you deal with business.
And
I think setting each other up for success is huge, because, I mean, if he's the one that's supposed to be focused on the bigger picture and focused on these beers and, dedicated to tasting and brewing and all, you know, coming up with new ideas, then finding the people that can relieve him of the day-to-day, if it's something that I'm not good at, like production planning or social media or
whatever.
She's
also good at backing me up, though, and being like, hey, that thing you just asked James to do,
that's
is not
his
job.
Mm. Yeah.
So, like, you know, our employees, and they just go to both of us, and she'll be like, stop. Like, yeah, he's going to want to do that, but... And he could, but he doesn't need to. One of you can do that, or she can do that, or somebody else.
Yeah.
Which is good, because, I mean, still today, I feel like I do a lot of random stuff, you know?
I mean, welcome to owning a business,
right? Yeah, exactly.
Mr. Fix-It, James,
help. The toilet is broken.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm back there, like, putting in a new little flappy thing, like, whatever it is.
Why isn't
like,
the CoolBot running? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Fixing the, anything, so.
One of the things that I think probably put you on a lot of people's maps was post-Wicked Weed, when, I think it was after Jester King issued sort of their statement on how they felt about things and what they were going to do about it. You guys also did, similarly released a statement about what it meant to you and what you wanted to think, you know, how you wanted to present yourselves going forward.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the process of deciding to do that, and then how did you go about crafting that message, because it's a delicate thing, and you obviously took it very seriously.
Yeah, I mean, we found out the same way Jeff did, via text message, I think, from Walt early in the morning, an email, right before he went on stage and announced it to their employees. And I remember, like, literally, I was like brushing my teeth, and like an email came in. I was like, oh, weird, Walt sent us an email. Mm. And I think Sarah was like in the shower or something, and I was like about to leave and go to work, and I was like, did you see this email? She's like, no, I'm in the shower. I didn't, I'm not looking at emails yet. And I was like, oh, Wicked Weed just sold to AB InBev. And she was like, whoa. And I was like, immediately, I was like, so we have a collaboration with them in barrels now.
We had two going with them, one there and one at our place.
Yeah, one they did at our place and one we did at their place. And so I was like, I don't think we can sell it. So we need to figure out how to like say something about that, or like come out and say, listen, we're friends with these people, but we're not friends with AB InBev, and we can't be part of that. So this collaboration is going to have to be not a thing. And to be fair, Walt mentioned it in his email, like, hey, I know we have a collaboration going. What do you think? And,
So he must have known that was going to have an impact then.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, he wasn't there when we did the collaboration, I think because he was in Europe.
talking to
people about it. So, I mean, it's fine. I don't expect to have some kind of advanced knowledge. But it was, then I'd...
So you had a choice to make about the beer, but then you also made the choice of communicating that to to your fans.
A long time.
And that went way beyond your fans as well.
Like
that became sort of a message to the beer industry overall.
Yeah, totally. And I think a lot of people also, and to be fair, Jeff also basically said the same thing, and it was, inspiring. It made it a little safe for us, but to be honest, we were already typing it up and just trying to get it out there.
But how did you, as a that's, you know, co-owners of a business, what was the problem? I'm curious more about the process of how you decided to say what you wanted to say. Mm-hmm. Like, because that's a real, I can't even imagine having to put that together. Like, that's tough. But, and of course, you need, it needs to reflect more than just one of you.
Yeah. Right? No, we've always been in agreement over that. We don't buy AB products, not because they're big, but because of what they represent to smaller breweries. I mean, especially in a place like Colorado, especially, and when we were former Future selling clean beers, it was so tough to try to sell an IPA or a porter to a bar that had mostly AB products on their lineup, because they could get basically the same thing for a third of the cost.
Yeah.
And so
I think they're also competitively, and maybe even not competitively, but aggressively, and what is the word? You know, they're undercutting, and they would enter a market and sell beers from these, you know, craft breweries that they had acquired, and they were selling them for much.
Yeah,
less.
Sometimes half.
I mean, drastically less, and that was. I mean, go ahead, but
yeah. I agree with you, and I think that in this market and in this day and age, I think more and more people are starting to talk politics with their money and where they spend their money. And, you know, Jester King has been such a, you know, a light for us, because they have such a wider audience than we would. And so it's they pave the way. But we, I think, can reach people in a different way than they can. And so it was kind of like a, you know, two-pronged attack.
Yeah.
You know, like, Jester King says it, and they have their reach, and and then we say it, and we have our reach. And they overlap.
Many more than people. Other breweries come out and said it. And look at the Wicked Weed Festival. You know, over 3 or 4 days, almost every brewery pulled out of it.
Yeah. It sent a very clear message, at least from what I could see, that the group of brewers that I don't know how to perfectly describe them, either as artisanal brewers or, you know, wild and sour brewers, or however you want to talk about them, there seemed to be, after that sale, there an expression of an interconnectedness between those brewers that you don't necessarily get in the same way as you do, you know, between typical production brewers or regional brewers you know, your sort of like middle of the road craft brewers. Like, there was very much a different kind of community that was being expressed through some of those messages that were being shared out. I don't think I'd seen that before. That was a new kind of expression overall. It felt very real and personal to people, and it was big.
I think that we were, Jeff, I know, and we are friends with Walt. And so that following weekend, we were in Nashville for the Wicked Weed Funk Fest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was definitely a somber kind of weekend, for not the whole weekend. It was fun too, but there was definitely like a layer of that in there, you know.
But no, I mean, I think people had a good time. But we talked about,
it was
the topic of conversation. And, you know, that sour wild beer community, most of them were there, and it was somber in a, somber in a fun way. But I mean, people were like, man, that's a bummer. Like, and we were talking about, man, when I heard that, like, I didn't know what to say. I was like crushed, you know, like it was like someone had died almost.
Why do you think there is that interconnectedness between these kinds of breweries? It seems very specific to breweries of this kind.
Well, Walt was very involved and is very involved in Wicked Weed. I think that that's a big piece of why it felt that way.
Mm-hmm. Not just the morning of Wicked Weed. Wicked Weed aside, seems to be an interconnectedness between these kinds of breweries that keeps you guys all very close.
Yeah,
that's a
good
question.
I mean, I think, I don't know. But
I mean, it's out there on the floor right now.
Yeah. I think a big part of it is it's very different making these beers compared to a normal production brewery making beers. And so I think especially those of us that only do these kinds of beers, there's an understanding of the lifestyle that goes along with that, which is I'm not glamorizing it. I'm saying it's, in some ways it sucks, because there is no predictability and all of us are, you know, fully invested, and this is all of our livelihoods. So it can be a big deal when, like, oh, that beer's not ready still after 10 months or whatever. Like, and I thought it would be, and like, uh-oh. And, you know, the idea of dumping like 20% of the beer that goes through a cool ship, like, people who use cool ships understand that. People who want to use cool ships and people who don't use cool ships don't understand that that's a thing. And like, that's a lot of dumping of beer that you, if you're dumping 20% of the IPAs you brew, you probably should stop.
Yeah, you're screwed.
Stop brewing, you know, like, but you know, and you dump them, you dump these beers sometimes a year or 2 years after you fruit it. So it's even worse.
Yeah.
So I think there's that. I mean, we were actually, just in Belgium, and I talked to some lambic brewers there, and they were talking about how even still today, or at least a generation or two ago, it was very common where many of them are sort of related or like something like that, you know, where it was very common to marry someone from a brewing family, because especially a lambic family, because people, they understood, and you were taking somebody, your spouse, that understood the lifestyle because they grew up around it, and just finding somebody else that isn't used to the idea of being to the brewery in all hours of the day for half the year, and the, you know, waiting around for the other half the year without any money coming in, that sort of thing, like, that's something that's really important. And so it just ended up working out that way. But I think that's on a little bit less intimate level sort of what's going on. That's interesting.
So it's not just that you're finding commonality among your intent or your inspiration, but people who mutually understand the risks and challenges involved in that particular thing.
That's a big part of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. What have you guys been excited to... Have you gotten around to drink anything today? I hope a little bit.
James has not. He poured basically every ounce of beer.
Oh, it's, man, sort of my thing.
I should let you out of here so you can go do that.
No, it's all right.
There's we have all day session. Tomorrow. Yeah, all day we'll tomorrow. The cherry wine, actually, that you were just...
Oh, yeah. Wasn't that great?
Amazing. I maybe went back 8 times.
Hmm.
Jesus. Yeah. she drank it all. No one else got it.
Can you give me more than an ounce, please?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that was amazing. But we have a cherry wine producer. They don't only produce cherry wine, but we have a winery out in Colorado that does cherry wine. Mm. And I would drink that all day, every day. It's amazing.
It's awesome.
She also likes Creek.
Mm.
True.
Obviously some connective thread there. Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Jiang A's lychee sour was really good.
I haven't had that yet.
They're a Chinese brewery.
Okay.
Yeah.
And their beer was really good. Yeah.
There's so many people here. It's unbelievable.
It's crazy. Yeah. We found out that my dad and I went on a trip to China. He's been traveling there for years and years for work. And we went there like for a pleasure trip, just for vacation a couple years ago. And he was like finding these craft breweries. There's not many, so it was easy to find the 4 or 5 that are there. And we went to Jing A and like met one of the owners and the guy that kind of does their marketing and stuff. And so it's kind of cool. Like, one of them's come back into our brewery then, and like I wore this sweatshirt I got there for, I don't know, a year until we got new Black Project sweatshirts. But yeah, I mean, so that was kind of cool to see them here, and like, it's a neat thing. So, yeah.
Pleasure getting to know you guys. I appreciate you spending
absolutely.
The time.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting us, you know, bicker back and forth. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Probably lots of editing.
For a couple that owns a business together, that was a remarkable lack of bickering. I'm astonished.
Good job.
Thanks for listening, folks. If you'd like to hear more from this series, there are a dozen of them published on GBH right now. If you'd like to support GBH, please join the Fervent Few and be part of a productive beer community alongside brewers, fans, salespeople, writers, maltsters, just about anyone and everyone who contributes to striking conversations in beer. We use Patreon to manage our members. You can join us at patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. Aim true, pour liberal, folks. Have a great week.